Coming up next on Passion Struck.
We're looking at the employees who gave a 1 or 2 or 3 out of 10 because they're very disengaged. They may be in danger of leaving. And so we've got a fire. We've got to put out the fire. It's an emergency. And what we don't do a lot of times instinctively is say, well, hang on a second. Yes, it's important to pay attention to problems, but do we understand why the 9s and 10s, the employees who are super duper happy at the far other end of the curve, do we understand why they're happy?
Welcome to Passion Struck. Hi, I'm your host, John R. Miles. And on the show, we decipher the secrets, tips, and guidance of the world's most inspiring people and turn their wisdom into practical advice for you and those around you. Our mission is to help you unlock the power of intentionality so that you can become the best version of yourself. If you're new to the show, I offer advice and answer listener questions on Fridays. We have long-form interviews the rest of the week with guests ranging from astronauts to authors, CEOs, creators, innovators, scientists, military leaders, visionaries, and athletes. Now, let's go out there and become Passion Struck. Hey, Passion Struck family, I have such an incredible guest for you today, Dan Heath. Welcome to the podcast, Dan.
Thanks so much, John. Great to be here.
Dan, I have been a fan of you and your brother Chip's books for years. If the listeners aren't familiar with you, you also have a phenomenal podcast that I listen to quite frequently. It's called What It's Like to Be. Congratulations on all your achievements.
Thank you. The podcast is still in its first legs. It's barely over a year old. We're about 50 million downloads short of your track record. We're doing our best. And it has been an absolute pleasure. So the conceit for listeners not familiar with it, in every episode, I talk to somebody from a different profession. Cattle rancher, a Secret Service agent, a forensic accountant, a mystery novelist. And I just ask them a million nosy questions about what it's like to walk in their shoes, what stresses them out, what are the highs of their work, what's a good day, what's a bad day. And it is just such a treat to hear people talk about their work and really get into the nitty-gritty details. And for me, it's a personal passion. I don't think this is ever going to be something that threatens Joe Rogan, but I really enjoy the process of making it.
Well, a couple of my favorites that I've listened to was Cindy Marble, who's a Secret Service agent. And it was so uncanny when I heard that and her describing that what they're always trying to do is to prevent someone from taking the high ground. Mm-hmm. And then, unfortunately, the Trump assassination attempt, where it was a colossal fail on that.
I went through exactly the same thought process as you, because that interview was published just a couple of weeks before that shooting. And I just remember wincing it. She had just said this was the result of the JFK assassination, that they learned you can never let the bad guys take the high ground. And so to have such a lapse, but I will say that I think this is just me speculating, so this is not factual, but my guess is what happened with that was also something that she mentioned in the episode, which is that the Secret Service plays this kind of unique, weird role in that it often is coordinating with a zoo of different law enforcement agencies. So you take a candidate on the trail, they want to go to the local diner, and you've got to get them from the airport to the diner through traffic, shutting things down and back. And so that may mean you're dealing with the airport authority and the sheriff and the local police, and it may transcend different jurisdictions. And my guess is what happened was basically a communication breakdown between this soup of different law enforcement agencies that were on site there. At least that's one man's personal theory of what went wrong.
What does seem to be, when you hear about it, how some were on walkie-talkies, others were on cell phones, others had different bands, that there it was really a cluster X situation.
Agree.
Another one I really liked, having spent a lot of time in London, was your interview with Jamie Owens, because I have always been amazed at just the depths of knowledge that London cabbies have in order to be granted the right to drive a cab. But yours really brought out some different dimensions when they had famous guests in the cab and other things. So I really enjoyed that one as well.
I was so excited to talk to Jamie, because Some of your listeners may know this already, but to be a London cabbie and drive the classic black cabs, they have to pass an exam that has been called the hardest exam in any discipline in the world. No joke. They call it the knowledge. You have to pass the knowledge to be licensed as a cab driver. And what that means is you have memorized basically every single road, street, alley, hotel, major building, bridge in Greater London, which is just a totally insane feat of mental gymnastics. And people spend years studying for this. I mean, you could probably become a doctor sooner than you could pass the knowledge. And so I just loved hearing him talk about what was involved with that and how do you train for it and what are some of the crazy questions they get asked on the exams. And it was heartbreaking to hear that in the modern age, so there are two paths to basically get one place from one place to another in London. You can either take one of these proud London cabbies that have passed the knowledge, or you can use Uber. And the qualifications to become an Uber driver are effectively nothing. Right? You've got spare time in a car. Maybe you pass a background check. There's no exam. There's no special vehicle. And it was just heartbreaking to hear such a proud profession kind of chipped away by the new entrant.
I mean, it really was. And having heard similar experiences from New York cab drivers, it rings true on both sides of the Atlantic. And one of the most fascinating things you were talking about, their pre-qualifications, is during this exam, they're asked to take people from point A to point B. And oftentimes the routes that they're given have construction, or it could even be maybe the prime minister is doing an event that day, and they have to be so up to knowledge on what's happening that they take the most direct route in order to pass the test. Mm-hmm. Like you're saying, it's just mind-boggling.
Well, Jamie told me one of the funniest ones is he said, if they thought you hadn't done your homework in a particular area, they would ask you for some just incredibly obscure detail. That government building on the corner of such and such an elm, what color is the front door? So it's not just, you can't just stay at home and study the map. It's not just that. It's all the contextual knowledge. It's what does this look like? And what's the history of such and such? And they might ask you to get from a certain hotel to a restaurant, but they don't tell you the name or address of the restaurant. They just tell you which chef just opened it. And so you have to know all of that kind of secondary knowledge like that. And I was just in awe of it. I mean, it's like a kind of intellectual Everest to me is the way I look at it.
Absolutely. Dan, I'm going to ask you about one last episode here in a second. But before I do, I just wanted to tell you this, that Passionstruck really centers on this overwhelming idea that everyone matters. And I love the people you profile because some of my favorite guests are what I call everyday heroes who no one really knows about, but they're doing jobs that really matter. And I find that intentionality is the key to creating meaningful change. So I was listening to your most recent episode with Sheldon Corsi, who's a Christmas tree farmer near Cincinnati. And the thing that really hit me was he was talking about his job is he's a farmer like any other farmer, but the difference between him and others is that he makes people's Christmas dreams come true and he makes other people feel like they matter. Mm. And I wanted to use that maybe as an intro. You can talk about that episode, but what does mattering mean to you?
I think that's a multidimensional question, and it's fun being the host of this podcast because I get to see how a lot of different people address that. And it's fascinating to see how different their answers can be. Sheldon, the Christmas tree farmer, he has this beautiful moment at the end when he talks about how on a day-to-day basis, he's occupied with the mechanics of the job. It's mowing the weeds in between the rows of Christmas trees. And he is a master of shearing the Christmas tree using a very long blade and kind of hand sculpting their growth. And he does that thousands of times a year. And so on a day-to-day basis, he's consumed by the particulars, but he says every now and then he just has a moment where he's able to stand back and maybe from a certain elevated place on the land that he works, he just looks out and sees all these trees that, are the result of his careful crafting and cultivation over the years. He's hand sculpted every one of them. And he just sees this beautiful vista. And it's like, he thinks, man, I've got it made. And so for him, it's like the achievement of that. And then seeing ultimately those trees find a home with a family that are going to make that tree the centerpiece of their Christmas, and getting to meet them and see them haul off the tree. His farm is one where you cut it down and take it with you. And so he gets to see all these trees that he's raised for 7 or 8 years go into their eventual homes. So that's his way of thinking about mattering. And then you take other people that might have very different careers. A hairstylist I talked to months ago talked about how people sit in the chair. It's almost like a kind of therapy. We've probably all experienced this. You find yourself just chatting with the stylist or barber to pass the time. And she says over a period of years, you see your clients grow. And it had just never dawned on me to think this way, but she said she had clients where she did their elementary school piano recital and then their prom haircut and their college graduation haircut. And then, oh my gosh, she's on site the day they're getting married. And just this trajectory of being able to see and grow up with your clients and see how they blossom and see how they change over time. That was her source of meaning and satisfaction. So it's been beautiful just to see how many different definitions there can be for what matters.
Oh, well, thank you so much for sharing that. I always love to get people's different definitions, because when you hear mattering, it seems like such an easy thing to describe or think about, but it's really complex and really permeates all aspects of life. So I want to turn, before we start discussing your newest book, to one of your first books. I want to take people back into time. So the time period here is the end of 2006, beginning of 2007. And I worked as an executive at Lowe's Home Improvement. And I had just gone from leading kind of cybersecurity infrastructure operations to being tapped on the shoulder to lead all application development. And we had about $1.5 billion budget, where the vast majority of it was going to application development type efforts. And we were, I remember I was talking to the head of strategy, who is a real good friend of mine. And he told me as I was taking the job, John, you guys in IT are phenomenal at delivering solutions that are irrelevant by the time they're delivered. And it really struck me. And part of the issue was the idea cycle was taking too long to go through the process of the system that we were using to get projects to go through this gating system through the executive committee, through all these subgates to getting delivered. And I happened to discover your book at this time and read it, and it really changed my viewpoint on the anatomy of how do you explain things so that they're stickier and that there's more of an urgency built underneath them to get it done more quickly. But I have to tell you, as I was going through this, I happened to go, I think it was probably 8 or 9 months later, I was at NRF, the National Retail Federation's big event in New York City. And I was fortunate enough to be working with a vendor who took us into this room and said, we have a special guest that we're going to introduce you to. And it was Tom Ridge, who had formerly been the first director of Homeland Security. And so we're in this room and we're talking to him, and we start, for one reason or another, start talking about this war on terror that President Bush was deeply involved in, and that he was at the epicenter when he was Homeland Security. And I happened to talk to him about it, and I said, Secretary Ridge, one thing that really strikes me is that this idea isn't sticking, and part of the reason it's not sticking is you're not using any type of scorecard for the American people to make them understand what progress is being made, what isn't being made, et cetera. And I took some ideas that you had from the book, and I actually said them to them. And I'm not joking. 2 weeks later, the president comes out with a national address and said, going forward, we're going to be using a scorecard to, he basically took everything I said to Tom Ridge, and Tom Ridge had must have had a conversation with them, and they actually incorporated our discussion into national policy. So
no
I
way.
I just share that.
Wow. The temperature is yellow, that stuff, it came out of that?
Yes.
So we can claim co-credit for that national spot. What was it? A stoplight? What was the metaphor? A temperature gauge or a stoplight? Or was it just a color spectrum? I forget.
Yeah. I mean, I was telling him that we use balanced scorecards all the time to look at the progress that we were making and to justify more attention being put on things so that they're sped up. And I suggested to him that they use the same type of thing to indicate pain points and progress and other things to make people understand what all the money and attention is doing.
Man, what a great story. Thanks for sharing that. Boy, you made the most of that moment.
Well, it was just one of those lucky things where I just decided to speak, and he was kind enough to have that air about him that allowed you to speak to him, and I felt comfortable doing it.
That's so good.
Well, Dan, the book we're talking about today, which is your brand new book that we'll have released when this episode comes out, is titled Reset: How to Change What's Not Working. And to me, this whole idea of mattering, I think, really plays into this whole idea of reset. How does this concept of mattering resonate with the framework you explore in Reset?
I think the starting point for Reset, the problem it's trying to solve, is the problem of mindless and undesirable autopilot. Like you've reached a point in your personal life or at work where you're going through the motions, you're trapped in the gravity of the way things have always worked, and you want something better and different, and maybe you've made gestures in those directions before, but nothing's really changed. And so this kind of complacency has set in. In fact, the first story in the book to me has become a kind of symbol for this. So it starts in a receiving area in a hospital, Northwestern Memorial Hospital. And in this receiving area, there was a red phone on the wall that rang all the time. It was usually like a staffer or a nurse calling to check on the status of some package they'd ordered, maybe some medication or some surgical gloves or whatever. And so somebody in the receiving area pick up the red phone, get the call, and then go on a kind of scavenger hunt around the receiving area. Like it was just chaos. It was trying to find something in a hoarder's attic in those days. And the numbers say it all. It took them an average of 3 days to get a package delivered within the hospital, which is just nuts, right? You order a medication and maybe FedEx or UPS get it halfway across the country in a day or two. And then to get from the basement of the hospital to the third floor might take another 3 days. So this is a fantastically expensive problem because sometimes medications just expire right in the box because they're not put in a fridge in time. Sometimes it leads people to overorder because they're afraid they're not going to get their package in time. Sometimes people are trying to make side deals with the UPS driver to just bypass the receiving area and come straight to their floor. And what I would say about this situation is that the people working in the receiving area were not incompetent. They were not dumb. They were not lazy. They were stuck. They were working a hard day every day. They came to work, they did their best, they went home. And when you rack up enough days, and some of them had been working there for decades, so they might have had 20 years in a row with an average track record of 3 days to deliver a package. You just come to assume, well, that's just the way reality is, right? That's the physics of my world, is it takes 3 days. And so the departure point for the book is to say, when you're in a situation where things aren't the way you want them to be, and you aspire for more, but you're skeptical you can get to more, what do you do to escape that trap? And so those are the first couple of pages in the book, and I think a metaphor for what's to come.
One of the things I love that you use throughout the book is really simple but well-meaning illustrations to convey many of the points. And in the same introduction that you're talking about, you use a metaphor of a boulder. Mm-hmm. I'm going to change this a little bit because something that an analogy I use and what I'm talking about here is being stuck is imagine you're at a point in time when you're driving a car and you don't have your cell phone. Mm-hmm. And your car runs out of gas.
Mm.
You're really stuck with two paths. You can either put your hand up in the air and try to get someone to come over and give you help. But if not, you're either going to have to walk or you're going to have to push your car to a place where you can fill it up. And let's take that path of pushing the car because I think it's like your analogy to a boulder. So as you write in the book, when you're thinking about pushing this car, we often make the mistake of thinking that we can't do it because of a lack of effort, meaning it's going to take more effort to do it than we're possibly able to achieve. But I love how you frame this because in order to move that car or the boulder, you've got to be smart and strategic. The thing that I really love that you use here is a term that you have in the book called a leverage point, which was originally popularized by Donella Meadows, but it really captures the situation because you're looking for a change of equilibrium on how do you push that car in an efficient way that you're going to start getting momentum. And I think the same thing applies to changes we want in our life or in the work environment too. So can you take that analogy and maybe run with it a bit more?
Absolutely. In fact, the very heart of the book is a very simple two-part framework. So the idea is to get unstuck, to get to a different and better equilibrium, you've got to do two things. One is to find leverage points, which is just an acknowledgement of the fact that in complicated situations, we can't change everything. We can't change most things or even maybe a significant fraction of things, but we can change something. And so leverage points are the something we want to find because that's an intervention or an action where a little bit of investment yields disproportionate returns. So that's part one. That's like, where do we aim our efforts? And then the second part is, how do we push in that new direction that we've identified? How do we get the force, the fuel we need to go in a new direction? And it's compounded by the fact that we probably don't just have satchels of free cash on the sidelines or idle employees that we can draft into duty. Like, we're probably stuck with what we have today, which means we've got to reorganize, realign. In the book, I use the phrase restack resources to push on those leverage points. So that's it. Find leverage points, restack resources. Very simple, but of course, it's really complex to do those things. Like the first half of the book is about the detective work of where do you find these magical leverage points that let you do a lot with a little? And the second half of the book is about how do you make these trade-offs where you stop doing X and start doing Y, or where you find previously untapped resources to employ? Like, where do you find those, that fuel that you need to push in a new direction?
And I can't wait to explore some of this. I want to start out with something that you describe as situations of bad equilibria, where people or systems are trapped in unsatisfactory patterns. And what are some of the telltale signs that we or our organizations are stuck in one of these cycles?
I think we know it in our guts. I think what happens a lot of times is, like, to go back to the receiving area, I don't think anyone in the receiving area felt like they were at their ideal level of performance. So it's not that they were deceiving themselves. It's more like a kind of learned helplessness or defeatist instinct. Well, it's always been this way. We tried things over the years to do something different. They never went anywhere. So it must just be the way things are. So I think part of it is just reawakening our sense of agency. Hey, wait a minute. We don't just have to accept this as nature as the way things are. We do have influence here. We can do something. And the second thing is sometimes it's helpful just to look outside to get a new influence. In fact, what eventually triggered, we can come back to Northwestern later, but what eventually triggered the turnaround, because they did turn around completely. But the catalyst was a guy named Paul Suet, who came from outside, took over the department. His background was in lean manufacturing. And so he was used to looking at things from a systems lens. And when he came in, it was just immediately obvious, hey, things can be different here. And if I can convince this team to trust me on this journey, like we can go from being the pariahs of the hospital to the superstars.
Well, it's absolutely true. And I want to go through a couple of chapters of the first section. And let's talk about chapter one, because to me, this really coincided with some of the value systems that I saw at Lowe's. Mm. This title, this chapter really emphasizes going and seeing the work. And Lowe's had its own fleet of aircraft. And part of the reason for that was because if you were on the supply chain side, merchandising side, or stores operations side, those folks were constantly in the field going to see the distribution centers, going to see the stores, because that's where the cash was made, to get firsthand observations for spotting inefficiencies or pain points or something else. And in the book, you talk about the work of Don Keifer and Todd Aster, and also a case study in the MIT Sloan Management Review.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hoping maybe you could share that as an example for why it's so important to see this work.
Yes. And first, I want to give proper credit to Nelson Repenning, who's an MIT professor, as the source of the phrase, go and see the work. That's the chapter title. So here's the spirit of that. Repenning and his colleagues tell the story of a corrugated box manufacturer. And the boss notices that their paper waste is higher than industry averages. So that's an example. We were just talking about you looking outside. Well, you compare yourself to outside. Hey, wait a second. We're not performing as well as our competitors. Why is that? And so the boss just goes and sees the work, which means get closer to the ground level. So in a factory situation, it means walking the factory floor, watching the way things are made. In a hospital, it might be following a patient journey from check-in to procedure to check-out. In a school, it might mean, and one of the stories in the book is about a principal who followed around a ninth grader all day long, including sitting in the classes and sitting in the lunchroom. That's going and seeing the work. So back to the paper box manufacturer, the boss walks around and notices this corrugating machine, which is one of their signature assets, is shut down during lunch. And he asks why. And the first couple of people he asked don't know. Eventually runs down the answer. His years prior, there was some instability from the local utility that provided electricity to the factory, and it seemed to be concentrated around lunchtime. So they just started kind of preemptively shutting down the machine, because it wasn't good for the machine to have variable power and just be abruptly shut down. And so being good systems thinkers, they thought, aha, well, we'll get ahead of this. We'll prevent any damage to the machine by shutting it down. But the way organizations work is, over time, things just become habitual. And so it just becomes part of your day-to-day checklist. Well, okay, did we shut the machine down for lunchtime? Yes, check. And months go by and months go by. And meanwhile, the utility has fixed the instability, but it doesn't change the fact that they're shutting down the corrugating machine at lunchtime. Years later, the boss is like, why are we shutting down this machine? Every time we shut down the machine, it creates waste because there's work in product. And then there's a startup cost, and then there's whatever was in the machine when we shut it down. And so that's one of the major sources of waste. And nobody has a good answer. And they eventually find they've been shutting the machine down for no purpose at all. And so that's an example of where, from a boss's perspective, when you're looking at numbers on a spreadsheet, our waste per month is such and such, it might tell you directionally something's not great. But you can't really diagnose it. You can't really figure out, hey, what could we change to get a better answer, until you go and see the work.
Oh, it's absolutely true. I would go on these visits with the the Lowe's executives, and I love going to the supply chain facilities. And if anyone's familiar with distribution centers, they're really focused on this concept of cycle time. Like how long does it take once a package gets in to get it back out? And once you start seeing how everyone in these centers and the Lowe's ones were like a million and a half square foot are operating, that there's a lot of inefficiency. And so they, while I was there, implemented something called putting people on standard, which was they started to automate that the way that they were picking, so that the system would tell them where the next item was, how long they had to pick it, and did it in a coordinated manner. So it didn't have them moving all through the facility, but having had them go much more directly from point to point. So it's the same philosophy. So
that's a great example of one of the chapters in the book is about waste. And waste is wonderful because if you can find places where you're spending energy, time, money, cash, whatever, to no positive value, you can cut it instantly. Nobody suffers. And then you can use those assets to help assist in your push toward the leverage points.
Well, Dan, in chapter three, you discuss studying the bright spots, how focusing on what's already working can help replicate success. And in here, I loved what you wrote. You say averages are great for monitoring, but terrible for diagnosis. Averages can tell us something's wrong, but they're unlikely to tell us what's wrong or how to fix it. And one of the things that you brought up was Net Promoter Score. And when I was at Dell, that's what we used to judge everything was NPS. And the problem with it is it's really an average. Mm-hmm. So you use that as a backdrop to discuss these bright spots and why they're so important.
Yes. So I think, first of all, on the averages point, here's a simple way to think about it. So much of what leaders see is some kind of aggregate or average. They're just looking at big numbers like revenue, profit, net promoter score, employee engagement score. And these are directionally useful. If something's trending the wrong way, it tells you that. But consider this. Let's say you've got a leader going through a 360 where people are giving that person feedback. And there are two leaders that both have a 7 out of 10 score, pretty good, not great. You don't really understand anything about the situation until you've gotten closer to the data itself. For instance, imagine one leader was evenly split between 10s and 4s that averaged out to 7. So it's very bimodal. They're half the team loves them and half the team is really unhappy, which is a very different situation than a different leader where everybody gave them a 7. Like they're just moderately positive. No one is super excited. No one has a problem with them. You don't really understand the situation until you understand what's beneath the average. So one corollary of that is if you untangle the averages, you can often find, remember, we're on the hunt for leverage points. You can often find those leverage points by looking at the most positive data points underneath the average. So let me explain what I mean. Like employee engagement data is something a lot of organizations collect these days. You got your employee pulse studies and somebody's looking at those. Is it going up? Is it going down? But again, if it's like a 69% score or something, these are scored in a lot of different ways, but let's just say it's like the manager. Let's say you're at a 7 out of 10 level of happiness. You don't really understand anything until you've unpacked that and look at where the clusters of employees are. And specifically, I would argue that in most cases like this, our attention goes immediately to the problem areas. So we're looking at the employees who gave a 1 or 2 or 3 out of 10 because they're very disengaged. They may be in danger of leaving. And so we've got a fire. We've got to put out the fire. It's an emergency. And what we don't do a lot of times instinctively is say, well, hang on a second. Yes, it's important to pay attention to problems, but do we understand why the 9s and 10s, the employees who are super duper happy at the far other end of the curve, do we understand why they're happy? And that's the intent of studying the bright spots, is to try to understand why, when we succeed, we are succeeding. And that may sound obvious. Well, how could anybody not know that? But I'll tell you, my experience is people instinctively study the problems and people know when they succeed, but they don't study it. They celebrate it. or they're relieved that it was a success so they can spend more time on the problems. But we rarely study with the same tenacity what is working as we do what's not working.
I mean, I think that's a great point. And I always use this example is so many people talk about their bucket lists and what they want to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
But I always tell them to look at their reverse bucket list. What are all the positive things that you've accomplished in your life that you never thought was possible? Because that really gives you that inner fortitude to feel like you can take on things where maybe you feel fear or self-intimidation or something else. So I love that chapter.
Well, and I know a lot of your listeners are thinking about personal growth. And just for pure truth in advertising, just this book is probably 75% organizational and 25% personal. So I don't want to sell something improperly. But this Bright Spots idea translates directly to personal growth. I've used it many times myself because the idea is, let's consider a New Year's resolution. And most people set these lofty resolutions. And of course, we all know most people fail and they abandon them. And then we beat ourselves up. But the Bright Spots philosophy says something very different, which is, maybe you started the year swearing that you were going to work out 3 times a week. And maybe at the end of January, you've only gone 3 times total instead of 3 times a week. So from the way we've been taught, that's a failure. But what Bright Spots says is, no, you've got 3 bright spots. In the face of all the things you had to do, all the commitments you had, all the stresses you faced, all the unexpected problems, you still managed to triumph 3 times. And here's the important part. How? What was different about those 3 times? Was it a certain time of day? Did you go with a friend? Did you pre-pack your clothes in the car so it was just 3% easier? If you can understand what allows you to succeed, even if it's in certain circumstances, that opens the door to try to reproduce that.
Such a well-said point. And I think, as you said, the book does have more applicability to organizations, but I did find some direct bright spots throughout it that people could apply directly to their lives. And this was a key one, which is why I decided to focus on it.
Yeah, I'm glad you did.
Another chapter I have to go into is chapter 4, and I'm going to introduce it like this. My brother works at Chick-fil-A and absolutely loves working there. And I happened to be driving where I live here in St. Petersburg by a brand new Chick-fil-A that was being built. And I got him on the phone and I'm like, Pat, there's a new Chick-fil-A being built. And he said, can you stop and take pictures of the drive-thru? Mm. And we are piloting a new double drive-thru covered that we're putting into more markets. And I started asking him about the drive-thru because for me, when you go to so many of their stores, you almost don't even want to go into them because they're like 80 cars in line, it seems. And you're like, this is going to take 10 years to get through. And I thought this whole section of the book was fascinating on targeting the constraint. And I'm hoping you can use that to dive into it.
Yes. Well, in a certain way, I owe this whole book to Chick-fil-A. So I tell the story of during the pandemic, my wife sent me out to fetch a dinner for the family. I've got 2 young girls and they'll only eat about 8 foods. And one of them is Chick-fil-A. So we spent a lot of time at Chick-fil-A. And I went there and I was crushed because it was probably the longest line I'd ever seen in my life at a drive-thru. I mean, it must have been at least 50 cars in line. And so, oh man, I hate lines. And so I just took a deep breath and just patiently started trying to come up with lies I could tell my wife to explain why I came home without the Chick-fil-A, but ultimately decided, okay, I'll put on my big boy pants and get in line. And what happened next completely flipped my emotions because this line was just steadily creeping forward. It was uncanny. It was almost like those automatic car washes you've probably been through where they just pull your car along. And I was totally fascinated by what they were doing. And I resolved to figure it out after I delivered dinner that night. It probably took me 10 or 15 minutes to get through a 50 car line. It blew my mind. So later I go back, I talk to the owner operator, a guy named Tony Fernandez. He tells me that their peak is processing over 400 cars in an hour. That's a car every 9 seconds. That is just not the way the world. I mean, you could put your kids through college before Arby's would process 400 cars. Let's be honest. So this is just a freakish level of performance. And so I began talking to Tony to try to understand how he'd gotten there. And he had just this laser sharp philosophy. He said, drive through flow, which is what they're managing to, is all about finding the bottlenecks, managing the bottlenecks, or the word I use in the book is constraint, but they're synonyms. What's the limiting force in the system? And so, for instance, in a lot of drive-thrus, the bottleneck will be the menu board, the plate, the little, you know, menu where you order. And there are some these days that have two lanes. Most of them still have one lane. And so if you get behind that one person that gets to the board, and then they roll down their window and they're just dazzled by the array of choices in front of them, and they take 5 minutes to decide, like, that means your time in line went up by 5 minutes and the person behind you went up by 5 minutes. And so as an example, that's a constraint that Chick-fil-A, at least my local Chick-fil-A, said, well, what do we need a menu board for? I mean, it's nuggets and fries. Like, how hard is it? So they literally don't have a menu board anymore. They might have 5 human beings in the parking lot at once, taking orders right at your driver's side window. Those, you've probably seen this before. They'll walk up with an iPad and, what can I get you? I mean, imagine that, 5 people dealing with orders at once. There's not a drive-thru on the planet that has 5 different menu board lanes. So that gives them this incredible ability to scale up and down. If they're busy, maybe 4 or 5 people are taking orders. If they're slow, maybe it's 1 or 2. And here's the important thing. When you're thinking about systems, there's going to be a constraint. There's going to be a number one thing holding you back. So let's say in that case is the menu board. So Chick-fil-A figures out a way around that. Well, we can scale this up and down as needed. It's not like you fix the constraint forever. What happens is the constraint just moves somewhere else. So if you've got 5 people in the parking lot taking orders are streaming into the kitchen. Well, now the kitchen is the constraint. They can't keep up. They can't fry nuggets and fries that fast. So you got to get them more help, better systems. And then once the kitchen can keep up, maybe the bottleneck hops over to what they call meal assembly, where they box and bag your food and get it ready to deliver to you. And so that's how you manage a system, is one step at a time. You look what's holding you back, whittle away, move somewhere else, then shift your focus there, whittle away. And every time you do that, the system is getting better. And that sounds very operational, and it is. Operations people talk a lot about bottlenecks and constraints. But I think it's also possible to see the personal implications of that and to start thinking carefully about what are the limiting factors and the constraints in our own lives.
Absolutely. Well said. The second portion of your book, as you described earlier, goes into this concept of restacking resources. And it's basically, how can individuals or organizations identify where their time, energy, or money is being wasted and reallocate those resources to higher value activities? Sounds simple, but much harder to do than it sounds. And throughout this section, you go into Start with a Burst. Chapter 7 is Recycle Waste. Chapter 8 is Do Less and More. Chapter 9 is Tap Motivation. And I love talking about motivation. And chapter 10 is Let People Drive. And chapter 11 is Get Better, Faster Feedback. But I want to start out with Start with a Burst. And something that I want to go back to is that whole thing that I was talking about with getting this car moving that's stuck on the side of the road. Because in this analogy, the force you need to get it moving needs to be dramatically higher than the force you're going to need to keep it moving. And I think this is something that people don't look at enough, whether it's self-improvement or working on an initiative in a company. And getting it moving is where that burst comes in. Can you use this to expand upon this concept?
And that analogy actually works perfectly for the idea of a burst, because you're right. It's to get the car moving at all takes far more force than what you need to keep it going. And so what does that mean? Well, I love the example. We cite this guy named Greg McLawson, who's an attorney, but for the course of the story, it's more important that he's a husband. And he was working on a new watering system for his wife's garden. And so they had set up a bunch of hardware to make sure the garden stayed watered on the right schedule. But Greg McLaughlin said the immutable law of the universe is that you can never get anything you everything you need for a home improvement project with one trip to Home Depot. Or maybe in tribute to you, we should switch that to Lowe's. You can never get everything you need in one trip. And so he joked that even if you went to get one 60-watt light bulb and you got it, you would discover when you got home that actually it needs to be a 59-watt light bulb. And so this immutable law held true for him. And he figured out there was this one part he had bought that was defective. It was like a $2 cheap part. And so he said from like the perspective of efficiency, it would make most sense for him to just add that to his next Lowe's trip, which inevitably would be a week or two in the future. And he could just get that and piggyback on whatever else he was doing. But he said what mattered to his wife was not efficiency. It was finishing the project. She wanted the plants watered. And so he had to go back to get that $2 part. He said he probably wasted $200 in labor costs because he's a lawyer. He's billing by the hour mentally, and $6 in gas just to get that $2 part. And so he said it was a disaster from efficiency's sake, but he said it was a huge win from the sake of finishing the project, it working to completion. And he points out that efficiency is not always synonymous with effectiveness, that what his wife wanted was watered plants. That was the test of success, not how, quote unquote, efficient it was. And so we use that as a launching pad for this notion of when you want to change something, it's like that car on the side of the road situation. You need a burst of work up front that is designed not to be efficient, but to be effective, to get momentum going. And that can take a lot of forms. Like there's a methodology called a sprint used a lot in design and software circles where a team will literally clear their decks for a week. They'll all be in the same room collaborating live for one solid week. Everything else gets shelved and they're working towards something, back to work to completion. At the end of the week, they're going to have a prototype or they're going to have a shell website or whatever it is they're working on. And that provides the momentum. And think about how much BS that short circuits. If you don't do that stuff in a week, it's like you go from spending 35 focused hours in a week to spending 135 unfocused hours over 6 months. But by compressing it, you get that liftoff velocity that you need to start the change process.
Dan, the last chapter I want to talk to you about is chapter 8. I wrote in my own book about this concept of both and thinking. And so much today in the Western world, we tend to think of things as either or. And in this chapter, you introduce this principle of less and more. And in it, you write, this chapter is devoted to the trade-off of less of this, more of that. And what we're chasing in particular is a way to minimize the sting of those trade-offs. And you say in organization, it's not always a zero-sum gain. You can find low sting, high bang trade-offs. Can you tell me what you mean by low sting, high bang trade-offs?
Yes. So this came out of a conversation I had with a guy named David Philippi, who's a consultant at an agency called Strategex. They're zealots for the Pareto principle. I'm sure everybody listening has heard the 80-20 principle. And in the business world, you often hear 80% of the revenue comes from 20% of the customers. Philippi told me that's generally been true, although he said for profit, it's far more distorted. It's more like 20% of your customers are 150% of your profits. And what does it mean to have 150% of your profits? Well, what it means is you're serving a bunch of customers who are actually unprofitable. Like you would have a better business if you had a whole segment of customers go somewhere else. So Philippi said they do this thing where they will force rank customers by profitability from most to least profitable. And he said that in almost every case, what they find is that the enterprise's worst customers are overcoddled, getting too much time and resources devoted to them, and their best customers are undercoddled. So one tangible example is he says a lot of times the on-time delivery rates will be better for an organization's worst customers than their best, which just seems befuddling, right? How could you treat your worst customers better than your best? But the worst customers are just buying kind of nickel and dime stuff. Maybe it's the kind of thing where you can stick one part in a box and mail it out and it's easy. And your best customers are spending tons of money with you and they're doing these complicated things and maybe they're assemblies that require a lot of collaboration and maybe your shipping department procrastinates those. And so it's this paradoxical thing where you're treating your best people worse than your worst customers. Now, all that is about profit analysis, but I actually want to take that in a different direction. I wonder if that same analysis could also apply to almost any situation in life, including our personal relationships. Imagine if you did a ranking of all the relationships in your life from most precious to least. And so at the top might be your spouse and your kids and your parents and your relatives. And at the bottom might be those relationships that are consistently stressful, anxiety provoking, maybe even toxic, take a lot of your time, don't give much back. And isn't it almost certainly the case that we're probably under coddling those people at the bottom at the expense of the people we care most about? So that the chapter kind of makes this point that if we're looking for more resources to push in a new direction, back to this idea, find leverage points, restack resources, isn't this almost like an evergreen methodology you can use to steal from the overcoddled customers and relationships and projects and time expenditures in your life and reallocate those to the undercoddled, the ones at the top that you care most about?
Well, Dan, such a fantastic book overall. I really enjoyed reading this. It's something that I want to give my son, who's 26, as he is getting more and more in the workforce, to understand how to utilize these principles better. And I am so glad you've brought another phenomenal book to the world. If someone wants to learn more about you and where they can find the book and your other books, where's the best place for them to go?
Well, I was going to say two things, but it's actually all in one place. My name is Dan Heath, spelled like the candy bar, danheath.com. And that will give links to, we talked about the book Reset. And we also talked about my podcast, What It's Like to Be. And both of those have really visible links on that danheath.com site. Thanks for asking that.
And the last thing I just wanted to say is, for the listeners, Dan and his brother have written so many other books that I would also recommend: Upstream, Power of Moments, and perhaps Switch, which is How to Change Things When Change is Hard, which may be, prior to this book, my favorite one that you had written. But Dan, such an honor to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, John. It's been a treat.
What an insightful conversation that was with Dan Heath. His practical framework for getting unstuck, finding leverage points, and restacking resources is a game changer for anyone looking to make meaningful progress, whether in work, relationships, or personal habits. One of the biggest takeaways from today's episode is the power of progress as a motivator and how it ties directly to our sense of mattering. Dan's examples, from Chick-fil-A's efficiency to eliminating waste in a hospital receiving area, remind us that even small, intentional changes can create a ripple effect of transformation. As we wrap up, think about the areas in your own life or work where you feel stuck. Are there leverage points you can target or resources you can reallocate to focus on what truly matters? Remember, meaningful change doesn't require monumental effort. It starts with identifying a well-chosen something and taking intentional action. If today's episode resonated with you, I'd love to hear your thoughts. Please take a moment to leave us a 5-star rating and review and share how you're applying these insights. And if you know someone who could benefit from Dan's message, please share this episode with them. Your support helps us grow this community and empower others to make intentional change. For links to everything we discussed today, including Dan's book Reset and tools he shared, check out the show notes at passionstruck.com. As a reminder, I'll also put the video for the Podcast Hall of Fame there as well. You can also support the show by visiting our sponsors at passionstruck.com/deals, where you'll find discount codes and special offers from our partners. Every resource fuels the show and helps us bring you inspiring content every week. Beyond the podcast, I am passionate about sharing these insights with organizations and teams through speaking engagements. If today's episode sparks something in you and you think these messages could inspire your organization, visit johnrmiles.com/speaking to explore keynotes, workshops, and other opportunities. And don't forget to subscribe to our Live Intentionally newsletter and watch today's conversation on YouTube. Before we go, here's a preview of what's coming up next on Passion Struck. Joining us is Dr. Allison Wood Brooks, a Harvard Business School professor and author of Talk. In this episode, we dive into the science of conversations.
why they matter, how to make them impactful, and how to navigate even the most challenging interactions. It's an episode packed with actionable insights you won't want to miss.
So your question is, how can we think about the way that we communicate? How does that relate to us mattering? It's such a profound question. I think one thing that I've learned by doing this research and teaching this course about conversation is that our evidence to ourselves and to other people that we matter and that they matter, the place where that happens is so often during our conversations and in these little tiny moments where we make small choices that show, oh, I believe in myself or I believe in you. And the difference between micro kindnesses and micro harms, sometimes when you're looking at a transcript, they look very subtle, but I think in the emotional experience of those interactions, the difference can be massive in terms of how much you are conveying that you believe that you matter and how much you care about the other person and convey that they matter.
Thank you, as always, for spending your time with us here on Passion Struck. If you found value in today's episode, the fee is simple. Share it with someone who could benefit. And as always, do your best to apply what you learn here so that you can live what you listened. Until next time, live life Passion Struck.